I'm Gabrielle Jackson, and this is The Full Story, Newsroom Edition, where Guardian Australia's editors discuss the news of the week. Three events this week have led to serious questions about increasing secrecy surrounding decisions made by the Morrison government. We saw a Senate committee hand down a report into press freedom in response to federal police raids on the ABC and News Corp.
Federal police came knocking on Annika Smethurst's door, trying to discover who leaked classified papers to the News Corp political editor for a story published early last year.
There are six AFP officers and about four ABC lawyers, and they're going through email by email. And I feel, as a journalist, I feel it's a real violation.
Independent Senator Rex Patrick led a challenge to the secrecy surrounding COVID-19 decision-making.
How they decided what the rollout was. What's the rationale behind the lockdowns? What is the rationale behind a hotspot? All of those sorts of things, I believe, ought to be in the public domain.
And there's been a challenge to the secrecy of a court case itself held in secret. Today, I'm talking to Editor-in-Chief Lenore Taylor and Head of News Mike Tisher about how the Morrison government avoids accountability. It's Friday, the 21st of May. Good morning, Lenore.
Morning, Gabs.
Morning, Mike.
Morning, Gabrielle.
So this week there was a press freedom report released. Lenore, what was that all about and what was in it?
So it was a committee of inquiry that was set up after the raids on ABC and News Corp journalists, which sort of finally focused attention on the culture of secrecy that has been sort of steadily expanding in Australia for a long time and the increasing difficulties of journalists doing their jobs in the way that, you know, we certainly think is necessary to hold people to account. It was a Greens-dominated committee, so the government ministers issued a dissenting report. And so I guess back in the real world, it probably isn't going to have an enormous amount of immediate practical impact but it did serve to like highlight or focus again on these really important issues that, you know, are going unaddressed about how it's becoming harder and harder for us to do our jobs and the culture of secrecy in Australia is just increasing.
And Mike, it is becoming harder and harder for journalists to do their jobs, but it's also hard to get the public interested in that. How do you manage writing stories in a way, or editing stories in a way that gets people to care about these kinds of issues?
I think it's extremely difficult because the kind of stories that people want to read are the ones where we expose things that they did not know before or that governments or other people did not want to be known. So when you can say the government's been trying to keep X fact secret and now here it is, that's a great story. But if the story is just the government is trying to keep all kinds of things secret and we also don't know what they are because they're keeping them secret, that's a much harder sell.
A story about what we don't know.
Yeah, much more difficult for readers to engage with. So it's really difficult. And I think that's one of the great problems about this whole debate is that the government is on a good, everything is weighted in their favour because not only are they keeping stuff secret, but it's really hard to get people to care about the fact that they're keeping
it
secret.
And they make the laws.
Yeah.
And also I think they rely on the caravan moving on. You know, the news cycle is becoming faster and faster. And so, you know, things can happen at a time when suddenly there is interest. So those raids on the ABC and News Corp journalists did focus public opinion and there was international outrage and Australia's sort of crackdown on the press was world news. And at that time, the then Attorney General, Christian Porter, tried to calm things down a bit by issuing a directive to prosecutors saying they had to seek his approval before pursuing journalists through the courts. It was a thing that he said or did at the time to try and kind of lower the temperature. The Press Freedom Report found that that was highly inappropriate interference with the independence of the AFP and the Commonwealth Director of Public Prosecutions, that it set a dangerous precedent, that it should be stopped immediately, that that sort of thing should happen in law. But of course, the government wants the discretion so that once the storm clouds blow over, they can use their discretion, you know, to issue directions to pursue journalists as they want. So I think the other thing that mitigates against these stories sticking is that the government just has to sort of hold its breath for 5 minutes. And unless we really stick on it and try and find ways to engage the public and interest the public in these stories, you know, the truth is they blow over.
Mm.
And the other, in sort of in another part of the forest, which is something we'll come on to talk about in freedom of information, for example, those kind of stories are incredibly incremental when you're talking about increasing delays to freedom of information requests, you know, more being redacted, frustrations of getting them. It's like a journalist can't write a story every time their freedom of information request is denied
or delayed. And it sort of looks self-serving, yeah.
And it's boring, frankly, for readers. So, but that builds gradually into a whole system where we're being denied access to information, and that is a story.
What is freedom of information, Lenore?
Freedom of information is a legal process by which the media or any member of the public, for that matter, can apply to see documents from about certain topics from the bureaucracy or the government. There are parameters around it, so you can't get cabinet in confidence documents or things that are legitimately secret, and you have to define precisely what it is that you want to know about, but it is intended to be a way that the bureaucracy and the government is accountable to the citizenry. But actually what's been happening over many years is that it's just being killed a death of a thousand cuts. The government is starving the whole system of resources. The responses we get are ludicrous. You know, you honestly get documents back that say, dear so-and-so, and then everything is blacked out and then it says, you're sincerely so-and-so.
Mm.
I can't think of a more deadening, horrific job than being a Freedom of Information officer in a government department where your job is literally to try to give the minimum amount of information out to journalists, you know, and the process just gets frustrated. Nobody meets the guidelines for how quickly requests should be responded to. There's always disputes. The dispute process is underfunded. You know, the whole system is basically being run to provide as little information as possible, really.
And there was a report last year that showed the Prime Minister's department is one of the worst offenders in terms of granting access to freedom of information laws.
Yep. They met their legally imposed deadlines in 7.5% of cases. So clearly they don't take it very seriously.
I think one of the issues that really brought this all to a head was the COVID-19 decision-making. So National Cabinet was the meeting of the various state and territory governments with the federal government. And they made a lot of decisions, and those decisions were kept secret.
So I guess it's not so much the decisions themselves that were kept secret necessarily, but the process by which they arrived at and the information they were using to come to those decisions. So under what people normally understand as the cabinet, a cabinet of any national government, it's ministers. Ministers who are appointed by the Prime Minister, and they convene and make decisions. And the information on which they base those decisions is not subject to the normal freedom of information processes in this country. It's entirely confidential. Now, what happened in the pandemic this time last year or a bit earlier was that Scott Morrison created what he called National Cabinet, which is not ministers appointed by him, but it is the Prime Minister and the state premiers and territory leaders who came together to make decisions specifically to do with the pandemic. He created that as a subcommittee of the actual cabinet and therefore made it so that it was not subject to the normal FOI provisions either. Now, that is contentious because it is not constituted like a normal cabinet, and it's potentially stretching the definition of the cabinet so that more decisions in this particularly unusual situation currently, but perhaps also in future in different situations, will be kept entirely secret.
Rex Patrick, an independent senator, was in the news this week because he was trying to challenge this secrecy. What was that about?
So this case has gone to the Administrative Appeals Tribunal, where he's challenging that decision to create the National Cabinet, so-called cabinet, as being subject to the same provisions as the normal cabinet, whereby you can't make freedom of information requests to discover documentation and discussions about the decisions that are being taken there. And he is arguing that that should be subject to the normal FOI provisions.
He's also, I think he's doing it in part because of this particular instance and the need for transparency, but also because he fears that it will set a precedent and that Prime Minister or Prime Ministers in the future can call any old thing a subcommittee of cabinet and then it's secret also. it goes to show how much of the COVID decision-making was done in secret. Mm. So, you know, these are amongst the most consequential decisions that politicians will make in our lifetimes around one of the most consequential issues. And the government also set up that, what was it, the COVID Commission, so business people and people, to help them, you know, implement the COVID response at the outset. And that was also entirely in secret. So we didn't know what their conflict of interest disclosures were. We didn't know anything about their decision-making much. It was an entirely sort of ad hoc secret procedure, which was really absent any scrutiny. One member of that commission, Greg Combe, voluntarily gave us his conflict of interest disclosure, and we got a leak of one of their decision-making papers, which was saying that the government should underwrite a massive expansion of gas. But other than that, we know very little about what went on there. So it was another thing set up in a way that was like completely opaque.
Mm. So the government has said this whole time, we're relying on the health advice, we're following the science. But the fact is, we actually don't know that for sure, do we?
Not entirely, not entirely. I mean, the people providing the health advice do answer some questions, but in terms of being able to formally request the actual advice, no, we don't know.
Mm.
As we know, it's dominated our entire life for the past year and more, and there have been some extremely difficult but important decisions made all through it about life-changing matters, such as which vaccines we ordered and when and why we chose particular ones, how the rollout was designed. There was the whole question of the COVID Safe app, which they also refused access to data on. They just, that was potentially subject to FRO, but they refused our request for data on how many people were using the COVID Safe app. This was in September when we thought still the COVID Safe app might be of some earthly use in the pandemic. But these things are affecting our daily lives right now.
And the default position is to try and get around the already not adequate processes of transparency.
One of the other issues around transparency that came up this week was the case of Bernard Collaery. And I think the Press Freedom Report referred to the encroaching nature of national security laws on open justice as well. Lenore, can you just tell us what happened with this case? We've covered it in full story before, but what happened this week?
So yeah, we need to go back a little bit. So Witness K and Bernard Collaery, Witness K was the senior intelligence officer who blew the whistle about Australia's bugging of the Timorese government officers during highly sensitive commercial negotiations with Australia over gas. He did the right thing. He tried to use the system. He approached the intelligence watchdog to try and blow the whistle. He got permission to talk to an approved lawyer, Bernard Collaery, about his concerns about the bugging by the Australian government. But even though he went through the right procedures, both Witness K, the would-be whistleblower, and his lawyer, Bernard Collaery, are being prosecuted. And what happened this week is that Bernard Collaery is challenging the government's intention to hold his case in secret. And that case is itself being held in secret. So it's like a Sarah Lee of secrecy, layer upon layer of secrecy of this whole thing. It's just crazy.
Mm. And Mike, what does this say to our system of open justice?
Well, not. I think as I was described, it's pretty obviously terrible. It says terrible things about our system of open justice. And in this case, I think there is, as I was talking about before, it's hard, often hard to get people to read about secrecy because they don't know the substance behind the secrets that were trying to be revealed. But in this case, we do know, and it has received a lot of attention because it was an absolutely outrageous action that they wanted to keep secret, with namely bugging of a friendly, neighbouring and much poorer
in
country.
In order to gain commercial advantage.
Yeah. So in that sense, I mean, we know what this one is about, and the fact that they're trying to keep so much of the process secret is just, people can judge for themselves, but it just really looks like they want to keep it secret because it's embarrassing for the Australian government.
And it goes to the ineffectiveness of our whistleblower laws. So there's another case at the moment, Richard Boyle, a tax office official, who also says he acted in line with the whistleblowing laws to try to expose his employer's sort of aggressive pursuit of debts against small businesses. And I think it was this week or last week, the government determined that his case would also go to trial. So even people who try to use the accepted processes of whistleblowing are being taken through the courts. So it's sort of a little wonder. I think Peter Greste, the journalist who was detained in Egypt, and another academic released a report recently which found that whistleblowers were being scared into silence, and that was, you know, impeding journalists' ability to expose corruption and whistleblowers' ability to expose corruption. I mean, yeah, of course they're being scared into silence. When they see people who tried to do the right thing being taken through the courts, you'd think twice before you tried to use those whistleblowing laws.
So it seems like quite an alarming increase of secrecy. Is this government different, or is this typically how governments respond?
I think it has been like a gradual increase over time. So there was sort of a couple of decades ago when a real push to sort of have freedom of information operate better. I think over time, gradually, the secrecy provisions have been dialed up and up and up, and freedom of information laws have been more and more and more difficult to use. So I do think our ability to do our jobs is getting harder over time. Yes, I do.
What are the impacts on that for Australia's democracy?
That's a big question. And again, it's something very incremental. And, you know, it's sort of the boiling frog example, is where you don't really notice these things until, you know, as they gradually increase. And then suddenly you find yourself in a quite different situation than you previously imagined you were in. And there have been some really harsh comments, I think, from lawyers and other human rights activists and so on about some of these cases that really point in a quite disturbing direction. I mean, it's not to say we're becoming not a democratic country or anything like that, but in these aspects, for example, in the Witness J case, which is one we haven't discussed.
Let's just bring people up to date, because I think that's a really alarming example.
So Witness J was a case that we only found out about after it all happened, completely in secret in the ACT. He was accused, tried and imprisoned entirely in secret before anyone knew anything about it. It only came out by a kind of accident. In that case, the Human Rights Law Centre said secret trials have a long history in authoritarian states and they have no place in liberal democracies like Australia. And it was hard for anyone to disagree with that, but it's not just at that extreme level. I think that again, on freedom of information, we have previously quoted Peter Timmins, a lawyer and FOI specialist. What he said was the tone at the top matters, and that really seems obvious from the way we work, that all these cases are being championed, if at all, by independents, usually Rex Patrick, Andrew Wilkie, Zali Steggall to some extent. They get much less support, obviously not from the government, but even from Labor. Freedom of information to them and freedom of the press is not being pursued actively by the parties that you would hope it would be pursued by in government. And I think that is, you know, again, you don't want to overstate it. We're not on the brink of becoming a dictatorship or anything like that, but these cases all...
They add up. And also any remedies for it just keep getting delayed and downplayed. So the government has drafted anti-corruption commission legislation. Mm. It's taken years to get this far. The proposed Commonwealth Integrity Commission, the thing that the government's proposing, is so weak it won't make much difference even if it happens. In the budget, there was precisely zero funding for its staffing or its setup. So it's obviously not intended to happen until after the next election. And I think this has a broader implication. This is why we see scandal after scandal after scandal, rorts, pork barreling, et cetera, hit the headlines, go away, and nothing ever seems to happen. The reason nothing ever seems to happen is that we lack the procedural and legislative tools to make something happen. And that might seem clever in the short term for politicians because, you know, it blows over and the cycle moves on. But I think in the longer term, this is why people's trust in institutions is diminishing. Mm. It is because we don't have these things to hold politicians to account. And what might seem clever in the short term, because you get through a news cycle, you get through an electoral cycle, in the longer term, it's their own institution that is being undermined by their refusal to accept basic standards of transparency and accountability. They're doing themselves in the eye, and I don't know that they can even see it.
Next, alcohol, 7 years to make a decision, and a surprising moment of joy. And so now we get to what you can't get out of your head. Mike, I know you've got one ready to go, so shall you start?
You shouldn't make me sound too eager to talk about this subject, but...
You are.
So our UK colleagues published a story earlier this week about alcohol consumption, which was reporting on a study which said that any amount of alcohol consumption is harmful to the brain. There is no safe amount of alcohol consumption for the brain, even moderate drinking up to recommended limits. It's not a peer-reviewed study, I should point out, which is...
Thank God.
I'm not sure why we're reporting on it in that case. But it sounds like a frivolous point, but it's actually quite a serious one, I think. Obviously, like... many people who like to drink, I tend to gravitate towards the news reports about studies that say
the
drinking.
The ones that say red wine
is
good for you.
Really good for you in moderation. Obviously, we should.
I always read those.
We should not downplay the fact that alcohol consumption excess and over long periods of time is extremely bad for you. But there is a point, I think, that people enjoy alcohol and that there is a benefit to their psychological health if they take it in moderation. Mm. And that studies that say, you absolutely shouldn't take it under any circumstances. It's really bad. Perhaps in my case, this runs to stories by people who are saying, I abstained from alcohol and, oh my God, I feel so much better. And personally, I don't want to read those stories. No, but my semi-serious point is I think there is a psychological benefit that many people gain from taking legal drugs and illegal drugs sometimes. But obviously, we're not going to run stories saying, oh, great, that is. But, and that I found this story confronting for that reason.
And mine was a story about the fact that there is going to be a rehearing of a family law case which involved two special needs children after a Queensland judge's 7-year delay in delivering her judgment, which the appeal judge said was gross and deplorable, and one could only agree. Imagine waiting 7 years for a family law judgment. The appeal judge also said the delay had led to the original judge making substantial errors, and there was a reference to the court file being lost in 2019 and there being no evidence that had ever been recovered before the first judgment was handed down last September. I just find those kinds of egregious failures of the judicial system quite shocking. I don't understand how it can take 7 years to reach a family court judgment. I really don't.
Yeah, it's unfathomable, isn't it? I've got one this week because I read a piece that really moved me. It's by a woman called Courtney Cook, and it was my 10-month stay at a treatment centre for borderline personality disorder. And this facility is for mostly young girls who get such a bad rap, and they've all been through significant trauma. And I thought it was going to be really confronting to read it. But actually, when I read it, she found happiness in some of the routines. And what she discovered by the end of her stay was that most of the girls, despite the significant trauma they had been through, found ways to be happy. Yeah, I just thought the strength of this woman to write that story was really, really something else, and I love to see things like that in The Guardian. Thanks so much for joining us today, Lenore.
Thanks, Gabs.
And Mike.
Thanks very much.
This episode was produced by Christopher Norse and Ryan Pemberton. The executive producers are Miles Martignoni and me, Gabrielle Jackson. If you like this episode, don't forget to subscribe or leave a rating or review wherever you get your podcasts. Laura Murphy-Oates will be back with you on Monday. We'll see you then.